Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, more than a year after the city of Jacksonville passed a street-side panhandling ban, we get the latest on the federal legal challenge it provoked. Later in the program, celebrating five local women-owned bookstores and a director's update to a classic noir film that stars St. Augustine as a central character. But first, a new poll just released this morning shows nearly double the support for community investment around the stadium than for stadium renovations themselves. It's just one of the eye-opening discoveries in a survey by University of North Florida's Public Opinion Research Lab, which is run by Dr. Michael Binder, and he joins us now in studio. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the numbers I just mentioned. The deal proposed by the mayor and the Jags is not just a stadium redesign, but it includes this $300 million investment, community investment, around that area and around the city. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, this is something everybody always asks when you release polls, what surprises you? And most of the time, it's nothing. This time, this poll is just chock full of things that are really eye opening. And you know, about 41% of the community supports the stadium construction portion, right? Giving Shad Khan $775 million to redo the bones of the stadium, but 81% support the community benefits agreement, the $150 from the city and the $150 from the Jags over 30 years, that goes to all the projects that aren't actually anything to do with the stadium, whether it's workforce or homelessness or parks or anything of those natures. And then when you put them together, it brings the full package over $900 million. Support goes up to 56%. So really, it's that community benefits agreements that's pulling support for the stadium kind of over that 50% mark.
And it almost kind of flips the numbers, right? I mean, the community benefit component makes the project, especially among non-fans of the Jaguars, kind of in reverse. So it goes from 58% opposed to the paying for the stadium to 56% in support if it adds the community benefit component. That's really astonishing.
It's crazy, right? Spend, you know, $150 million more. Now, Jags throw in $150 of their own, but that ups the support by really a significant margin. And when you kind of look under the hood at the folks that are opposed to the $775, but then after you add in the community benefits portion, almost 20% of the sample moved more supportive of the entire package when you add in the CBI.
So would you anticipate that this is going to change the conversation at all? I mean, we've seen from councils so far, particularly among people who kind of count themselves as Mayor Donna Deegan's critics, they've said that this community benefit component is no good. It's dead on arrival. It shouldn't be a part of it. Let's just focus on the stadium itself. Do you think that this is going to change the conversation?
I mean, there's an irony to this that is the only thing, aside from a new jail, and we could talk about that later, that's really heavily supported in as part of this package. Yeah, some of the minor details like the Jags eating cost overruns and things of that nature are positive and supported by the community generally. But this CBA is really the only thing that's keeping this stadium deal above water. We asked another question, you know, if you could choose between the $775 million for construction costs and keeping the Jaguars in Jacksonville or other city priorities. 58% said other city priorities. So even when faced with the threat of leaving for Jacksonville, voters just in and of itself are opposed to that stadium construction cost deal. And it's the CBA that's really saving it. And I can't believe I'm up here saying this, but I mean, that's what the data say.
So you tried a different approach with this poll than you do in some polls. Instead of asking, you know, your most important problem question, you tried to ask more open-ended questions. How did you approach that and why?
Yeah, so we asked, what do you think should be the top priority for investment of tax dollars? And really, you know, the whole reason for this poll was the releasing of the stadium plan and the idea that if we're not going to get a referendum on this and the city says we're not and voters want one over 70%, we at least felt that they should have their voices heard in some large-scale random selection process like a poll. But we wanted to see how folks thought their tax dollars should be invested, because this is really what this story is about, right? we're investing, you know, almost $900 million in tax money. And infrastructure was the number one choice, 23%, followed by education at 19%, and then public safety and police at 13%. Downtown investment was down at 4%. The stadium was down at 3%. You know, that's not surprising to me that those aren't people's top priorities. But they are willing, if you attach it to these community benefit agreements, to at least go along with the stadium deal.
So in that infrastructure that people priority, infrastructure and roads, does that include a jail? Because that is obviously an enormous cost that is also bearing down on the city.
Right. I mean, that's part of the process. It's one of a myriad of things. I think the jail is getting a lot of discussion lately. And while it might not be at the top of people's minds, it's coming there. And we asked people specifically about the jail, how they felt about the $1 billion investment. That's what the council report came out as, you know, the price tag. Now, we didn't associate a funding stream with this and how the tax dollars would cost. But the idea that it is exceptionally supportive, over 70% say, yeah, let's get a new jail. Let's get it out of the heart of downtown, even if it costs $1 billion.
You think that that number might change?
I do think that number might change once you say, okay, well, it's going to require us a millage rate increase. Because let's be honest, the funding mechanism for the stadium deal is kind of some funny money, right? There's no tax increases associated, whether you're moving around timelines for the half-cent sales tax. And, you know, it's smoke and mirrors in a lot of ways. We're out of funny money when it comes to $1 billion for a jail. Like, that's, you got to pay for that. You need to pay contractors. That's real money. And eventually, somehow, you either got to raise or you got to cut. And whatever that ultimately ends up being, I think some of that support might come down once we find out what that would actually be.
The support for the jail, you were surprised because last year there was an estimate that the jail was going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of like, I don't know, $350 million maybe. That was like before this committee, this council committee went through all of its machinations. But now it's, you know, up to $1 billion just several months later. What did you anticipate that you would see in terms of polling?
I fully expected at least to be stagnant, maybe even decrease, right? When you almost triple the cost of something, 73% of registered voters said, yeah, I either strongly or somewhat support the idea of this. And that's crazy, right? Like, I mean, I understand that the value, and this has been kind of a talking point for a while, but sure, $1 billion, here you go. And yeah, these are things that surprise me. Maybe I don't know the Jacksonville voter as much as I think I do.
But this is also, you're asking in the context, as you said, of your tax dollars. You're not just saying kind of pie in the sky, ideally, would you like to see a new jail? You're saying, you know, would you spend your tax dollars on this?
Yeah. Are you going to spend $1 billion of city money on this? And 73% are like, yeah, we need to prioritize this. It's something else.
We've got a call from Mark on the west side. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
The title of this article should have been, the majority of Jacksonville taxpayers don't want money funded for a new stadium, because that's, you're saying about if you have to spend taxpayer money. Well, that's a no-brainer. Of course you have to spend taxpayer money. That's the end-all and be-all of this. So, you know, people in your survey said that we don't want the stadium if we have to spend taxpayer money for it. Well, you're going to have to. I mean, this pie in the sky about, you know, $150 million for the poor people. You know, that, again, that's, you know, the basic part of your survey, I think, says it all. It says these people, the majority of people in Jacksonville, don't want the stadium of the future if they have to spend $1 billion worth of taxpayer money. And of course they will.
Yeah. Good point. Thanks, Mark. I mean, I think your point is that the support rose when the additional cost was tacked to it. But, you know, to his point, only 3% of people in your poll said that they wanted to spend money.
That it's a top priority for them. And listen, you can have multiple priorities that you're willing to spend money on. I mean, I don't want to take it and mislead it, right? I think there's, people would agree that you need to spend money on schools. People would agree that you need to spend some money on police, what those numbers are. You can fight over, but I think you can only have one top priority. But no, the caller's right, right? Even when we poked people and said, listen, the $775 for the stadium construction costs, are you willing to do this, even if it means them leaving, or would you rather spend it elsewhere? Almost 58% said we'd rather spend it elsewhere. So
even if they left.
Even if they left. The caller's right there. You know, folks don't want to give a billionaire, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in corporate welfare.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about community reaction to Jaguar Stadium spending in a new UNF poll. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. Mike, I want to ask you, too, about your polling on just the importance of downtown to people. And you made a really interesting point in your poll release about the number of people who ever come downtown. So talk a little bit about that. I found that even surprising.
Yeah. And downtown has been talked about for decades before I got here and will be decades after I'm gone, I'm sure. But we asked folks, you know, how often do you go downtown for leisure and entertainment? A full 24% of our sample never goes downtown. Okay, great. Well, a few times a year, a couple odd events here and there, that's 46%. So 70% of our sample goes downtown a few times a year or less. Yet there's a willingness, not only for the stadium, but investing in downtown altogether. We asked folks what they thought about the importance of investing downtown. We had a couple of different answer choices for them. And 39% believe that investing in downtown is critical for Jacksonville and for its future. And then another 28% said, yeah, I see the benefits. I have a little bit of hesitancy, but I see the benefits of it. So if you kind of combine those two groups as willingness to spend money downtown, that's 2/3 of the sample are saying, yeah, like I see the value and I'm willing to do it. I have some concerns, but I'm okay with it. When 70% of the sample almost never goes down there.
We've got a call from Thomas on the west side. Good morning, Thomas. Go ahead.
Good morning to y'all. My concern here is that I feel that if they add the jail to the money they're already spending on the stadium, it's just going to cripple economic development in the city, and no progress is going to be made in developing Jacksonville in the foreseeable future while we pay out these large bills.
Thank you, Thomas. There's certainly some concern, Mike, that there are going to be a lot of people who feel like they need money, deserve money for their projects that there isn't going to be money for.
Right. And, you know, the jail is not on the city council's docket right now, and I don't expect it's going to be. There's a, even beyond this money for the stadium, it's been clearly articulated that come the fall, there's going to be a renewed attention on the old Lot J idea, the entertainment district downtown. That's going to have some city incentives behind it as well. So we are not done spending money in this neck of the woods. And the jail, I don't imagine, is going to be up until after that, at least.
I want to ask you about some polling that you did just about people's popularity numbers, because you usually run those through. Tell us what you found in terms of mayor, city council, state attorney, the sheriff.
Yeah, we tend to do job approvals just to see where people are at given states. And Mayor Deegan's approval rating was at 63% approve, which is, you know, quite good. That being said, you know, mayors generally do pretty well. You know, there was a time right after the JEA scandal around COVID that Curry wasn't. But even Alvin Brown, right before he lost re-election, was over 50%.
Is that right?
Yeah, we had him at 55% right before he lost re-election. But you know, so Mayor Deegan's at 63%, which is good for her. Sheriff Waters is at 64%. In some ways, that gap is closed. Sheriff Waters had been ahead of Donna for a little while. And then our state attorney, Melissa Nelson, she's up around 60% too. City council's a little bit closer to 50-50, but there's still some approval for city council. They generally tend to do worse than all the individuals too. But by and large, our elected officials have some pretty solid popularity numbers.
We've got a call from Erwin. Good morning, Erwin. Go ahead.
My question is, I guess the statement is, I've been here since 1977. When I came here, we had Sears downtown. We had a number of things downtown, May Cohen's, on and on. Since then, they built the landing. It was poorly maintained. Now it's gone. There's really, what is there in comparison to any large city? What do they plan to do to actually bring business and people to the downtown, and things that will impact people on a daily basis? Having a stadium, that's limited. Yeah, it's nice to say you got a $1 billion stadium, but that's very limited. And you're talking about tremendous amount of money and resources. When you drive from the north side to the west side to the south side, there is so much of an infrastructure need. But let's start with a downtown.
Yeah. Thanks, Erwin. You know, I sometimes think of the money that was spent taking down the landing, which I think is now in the neighborhood of, you know, inching towards $30 million.
Look at all that grass we have. It's so pretty.
There is a nice lawn. But you think, you know, what could it have been if that money had just been poured into redeveloping and reviving the landing? It surely would have made a significant difference.
Sure. And you know, the one thing to think about is, and this is important if you look around Jacksonville, it's hard for government to always be the driver of innovation for a variety of different reasons. There's an argument to be made that Jacksonville has a bright, growing, burgeoning downtown. It's called the Town Center. You know, people are living there. There's restaurants, there's bars, there's shopping. Now, traffic might be a little bit of a headache, but you know, there's an argument that that's downtown, at least as far as a mecca for people goes.
Sure. I will say, you know, at the last place that I worked, all of the young people moving to Jacksonville were moving into the Town Center.
There you go.
I just want to read an email from Mark. He says, I live in the Lake Forest neighborhood where we are overtaxed and underrepresented every day to and from work driving in our neighborhood. We get punched in the kidneys because the roads are atrocious. We have limited sidewalks as well. I would rather my tax dollars go to people than businesses. And then the Laura Street Trio, they are hideous. There's a lot of priorities the city has.
There's a lot of priorities. And, you know, the infrastructure aspect with roads gets so much attention because of the federal highways that kind of bisect the city and cut it in pieces are always under construction. Mm-hmm. That's not really the city's situation, but there's a lot of blame that goes. But some of these local roads, yeah, absolutely. Lack of sidewalks. Poor construction, aging infrastructure. You know, these bridges aren't exactly brand new either. You know, we're hoping, you know, there's not a disaster, but these things happen. Now, there's a lot of things to be concerned about here in Jacksonville.
Well, I appreciate you coming on talking about this morning, Mike, because it's just a fascinating set of numbers. I think it tells us a lot about where our city's head is at. And we look forward to your next one. I'm sure we'll have you back on not too long from now.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All right. Dr. Michael Binder here talking about the latest poll from the Public Opinion Research Lab at the University of North Florida. Up next, a citywide panhandling ban survives its first court challenge. We learn what's next in that First Amendment fight. Welcome back. An anti-panhandling lawsuit will remain in effect after a federal judge refused to issue an emergency injunction. To learn why, we're joined by Charlie McGee. He's a poverty reporter for the online investigative newsroom, The Tributary. Charlie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us how we got to this point.
So this is the impetus is basically a lawsuit that was filed in February by an organization called the Kozak Foundation in regard to an ordinance that the city of Jacksonville passed early last year. It's been dubbed essentially a panhandling ban. But what it does is it outlaws various forms of solicitation along what the city calls designated roadways, aka the busiest roadways in Jacksonville. It represents a little less than half of all roadways in Jacksonville, but we know how big Jacksonville is, and there's a lot of rural areas, and so these sort of vast, empty kind of roads are exempt, but the most high traffic areas, the ordinance essentially says that nobody is allowed to solicit donations, solicit a ride, any kind of solicitation. And the sort of underlying target was panhandling, you know, people who are homeless or maybe just claim to be homeless, asking for money, holding signs on medians in the middle of the road or alongside the side of roads. It makes that basically a punishable offense. And the Kozak Foundation argues in this lawsuit that this ordinance is a violation of the First Amendment. And the reason that they argue this is that they are not panhandlers, but they distribute a free newspaper throughout Florida called The Homeless Voice. And the people who produce and distribute the paper are homeless Floridians. And they go up to motorists who are parked at traffic lights, offer them the paper for free, and say, donate whatever you can if you want.
What's unique about this law is, I mean, it penalizes panhandling, but it also penalizes motorists if they give a donation or if they even give someone a bottle of water.
That's right. Yeah, there's a couple different elements within the ordinance, and one of them is, yeah, prohibition on basically any physical interaction between a motorist or driver of a car and the person who is soliciting. And so, yeah, that's one of the punishable offenses, and it applies to the driver.
And so the fact that the newspaper that they publish is at the center of this is the grounds for why this is being presented as a First Amendment violation?
That's right. They're basically arguing that, hey, you might say that, you know, panhandling is the only activity targeted here, but this also covers us. They say that they're distributors of the newspaper, who the solicitors of the newspaper, who've done this in Jacksonville for years, have been threatened with arrest multiple times in the last year since the ordinance was passed. And so they've essentially shuttered their distribution of the Homeless Voice in Jacksonville.
And I think we saw some numbers from our news partners over at Channel 4 in terms of the number of people that have been charged or arrested. They found that 69 people have been arrested, that the police have issued 670 warnings and 36 citations. So it is being enforced. This case was in court a week ago in federal court for a hearing on an injunction request. You were there. Remind us what happened and what the outcome was.
Yeah. So the injunction hearing, this was regarding a request or a motion that the Kozak Foundation had made in the case to basically say, look, we might go into litigation. You know, this might go to a trial, whether it be a jury trial or something. And in the meantime, while all that goes on, we're asking you, the judge, to bar Jacksonville from enforcing this ordinance, at least temporarily. And then when the case is resolved, what they're hoping is the ordinance will be scrapped permanently. And so they're saying, in the meantime, stop Jacksonville from enforcing this. And the judge didn't rule at the end of the hearing. That sometimes a judge will rule from the bench. But in this case, he took some more time to consider it and ultimately decided that he's not going to grant the preliminary injunction. So Jacksonville still is and is allowed to enforce this ordinance while it fights this lawsuit.
The threshold for an injunction in a case like this is pretty high.
It is pretty high. He basically said in his order that, you know, this is not an indicator of how I'm going to rule in the case. Basically broke it down to the court record at this point is too narrow to decide for him to say affirmatively that the plaintiffs, the Kozak Foundation, are likely to win. And that's sort of a high bar is if the judge says, you know, the merits of this case are so great that it seems like the city's going to lose. That would be what would be needed for him to have granted this injunction.
So the city is being defended in this lawsuit by the Office of General Counsel, which is the attorney for the entire city, including the city council. But they weren't always enthusiastic about this bill before it passed. So they're in kind of an unusual posture.
Yeah, I mean, it was a debatable, it was a debated policy. There's, you know, even when it was passed, there were sort of city leaders who were, you know, people involved in the community and a few council members who were critical of it, basically saying this is a little too punitive of a law. It is outlawing, you know, people who may be desperate for money and need it to survive, you know, barring them from even the possibility of getting those kinds of donations from people in a major area. And so it's a controversial policy, but the city's standing by it in court now.
There are other similar laws around the country, a lot of them being challenged on similar grounds. So is there any consensus in terms of, you know, legal minds? Is this all heading back to the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately?
It's hard to say. It seems possible, though, and we've seen the Supreme Court consider similar types of ordinances. Actually, one of the cases that applies to, I've cited in my reporting, is a case called Papa Cristo versus the city of Jacksonville. This was in the 1970s, and it was a different kind of law. It outlawed things like vagrancy and, sort of just broadly throughout the city of Jacksonville in the 70s. And that went to the Supreme Court. It was struck down as unconstitutionally vague, is what they say. And so it's hard to say that there's a consensus. You know, both the city and the plaintiffs in their filings have cited different court cases and precedents that sort of support each of their arguments. And so it's possible, you know, that's kind of one of the main reasons the Supreme Court exists, is to sort of give the final judgment on this kind of thing. And if this would be the case or not that goes, who knows, but it would be interesting if that did happen.
So this law applies, as you were saying, to kind of major arterial roads throughout the city of Jacksonville. But some people will remember, like, isn't it already illegal? I mean, the city did pass a panhandling ban 20 years ago or so.
Yes. Yeah. And that was it's interesting because this was a sort of debate in a couple of years leading up to this 2023 ordinance that's now being challenged. Is there were some, you know, complaints throughout the city that there was a rise in panhandling, specifically sort of children being used to panhandle at these roadway areas. And the whole concern was public safety, right? And that's the city's argument, is that, you know, we're not looking to restrict the First Amendment or overstep for free speech rights. We're just trying to protect public safety. And the law that you're talking about, you know, it's still on the books as far as I can tell, but the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office had said in 2022, they told Action News Jax that that basically past court rulings had ruled that panhandling is protected by the First Amendment. And so that had sort of watered down their ability to actually enforce that old ordinance. So it's another interesting element. It'll be interesting to see if that factors into the case of, well, you already have this existing law that sort of says the same thing in many ways.
So the current law that's being challenged, as you said, is predicated on the idea of public safety. And so the city came with some numbers trying to indicate that there has been some measurable decline in traffic incidents.
Yeah, that was one point that came up at the preliminary injunction hearing. The city, they couldn't say affirmatively, that, hey, since this ordinance has passed, we've seen this reduction in pedestrian on vehicle accidents, which happen at a high rate in the city of Jacksonville. Apparently, that was one of the arguments for passing the ordinance. But they said, you know, we have indicators that there have been reductions in the time since. But the judge challenged that point, basically said, do you have any evidence that this ordinance or the reduction in panhandling has anything to do with reduced pedestrian on vehicle accidents? And that is another one of the arguments the plaintiffs are making, is until the city proves that people panhandling around roads has anything to do with these high rates of these kinds of accidents in Jacksonville, this is an overstep. It's sort of too much of an assumption for the city to just say, well, let's ban panhandling, even though we haven't provided evidence that it has.
And we should say there is a provision that allows for permits in some cases, but it's a fairly high threshold of what is required of somebody seeking the permit.
Yes, there's a criteria. They call it, I believe, a charitable solicitation permit, which would allow you under various guidelines and restrictions to do certain kinds of solicitation in these high traffic areas of the roads. But as you say, you know, you'd have to get a permit from the city. You can only have said permit for up to 6 days per year maximum to do that. And you'd be prohibited from that every other day of the year. And some of the criteria that, you know, has come up that's been challenged the most by the plaintiffs is you have to provide the city proof that you have at least $1 million in general liability insurance coverage, which, you know, the Kozak Foundation argues, you know, we don't have the financial resources to do that.
Most people panhandling probably can't.
It doesn't. Yeah, that seems like a pretty high bar for someone who's asking for money on the side of the road in the first place. And they, you know, there's an exemption to that requirement, which says if you have been deemed indigent, which is basically a term, you know, that you're completely destitute, unable to afford it would just be out of the question that you could have $1 million in insurance coverage. But the Kozak Foundation argues is, well, we're not a human being. We are a nonprofit. So we aren't capable of being deemed indigent.
Oh, so it's almost, Well, Charlie McGee, thank you so much for sharing your reporting on this. We'll continue to follow this and we hope you come back.
Absolutely. Thank you. Check out the Tributary to get follow-up.
Coverage. Absolutely. Check out the Tributary any day.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Up next, a women's writing group that puts banned books back on the shelves.
About the way you walk and whisper and look, I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make two lovers a friend.
Welcome back. It's a dynamic time for women writers on the First Coast, and an event this weekend is going to showcase some of their voices and accomplishments. Here to talk about it, I'm joined now by Shani Hall, author and board president of Women Writing for Change. Hello. Welcome.
Hi.
I'm also joined by State Representative Angie Nixon, owner of the Cafe Resistance Bookstore on Soutel Drive. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. And Casey Trulio, co-founder of Rebel Readers. Hey, Casey.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So glad to have you. So, Shani, Women Writing for Change is a local affiliate of a national group. What is the goal of either the local or the national group?
I think the goal for both, both the national and local, is to really give a voice to those who are voiceless. We try to work with underrepresented writers, namely minorities and BIPOC women that do not get a chance to write, number one. And number two, it's a way for us to heal and build communities.
For people who don't know the term BIPOC, remind us of what it stands for.
BIPOC, and I'm going to look at my, it's going to be Black.
Indigenous people of color.
Thank you.
Thanks, Angie. All right. And so you focus on creating kind of a space that's safe for women writers. And you do that through something called Circles. What does that accomplish?
It really accomplished the ability to give safe space for women to voice their thoughts and opinions where there might not be uncomfortable, or give the opportunity. And it really serves as a foundation for us building community.
The goal is to be welcoming and sort of free of judgment.
Definitely free of judgment.
Yeah.
It's somewhere where you have the ability to write down and communicate your innermost thoughts. And again, you don't have to share it. You can keep it to yourself, or you can take the opportunity to share with like-minded people.
So Casey, you're a co-founder of Rebel Readers. What led to the creation of that group, and what does it do?
So we were born directly as a result of the most recent book banning in the state of Florida. Katie and I are both former educators, and so we just thought, we saw firsthand the literacy rates declining and students struggling with reading and writing, and we were born out of just wanting to provide unobstructed access to multicultural, diverse, banned, and challenged literature.
What are you seeing in terms of book bans? Is that what you're saying is contributing to problems with literacy, problems with engagement?
Absolutely, absolutely. Book banning doesn't help anyone. What a child reads should be determined by that child and their parent, and that's what we are trying to facilitate.
And you're a former educator?
That's correct.
And so you were seeing some of this while you were in school?
Yes, ma'am.
And yes. So what was the kind of feeling in the schools when you were coping with these book bans among educators?
It's a weird feeling of helplessness, honestly, because we see a problem and we know how to fix it, but we could lose our licenses for fixing it. by providing access to literature, that it only takes one parent to file a complaint and have a title removed from the entire district.
So there were 565 books, Representative Nixon, in 2021 and 2022, and that number went up to 2,700 in the following year, in 2023. Most of those complaints coming from Northeast Florida.
Yeah, I mean, a lot having to do with the Moms for Liberty camp. And so what we've seen over the past few years is there's a concerted effort to basically attack public education and to make it seem as though our teachers aren't doing their jobs. It's become really politically polarizing to the point where, you know, even my Republican colleagues decided to pass legislation this past cycle, this past legislative session, to limit the number of times you can actually go out to try to ban a book, basically. And it's just wild, right? And it's hurting our students, especially Black students. You know, according to a national organization, Black students in eighth grade, there are only 44% of them are proficient here in the state of Florida. And that's one of the reasons that I decided to open up my bookstore alongside my daughter, in addition to what Rebel Readers is doing, right? Like, to actually put those banned books, which I would like to call liberated books, those liberated books on the bookshelves. It's just amazing when Black students come into the store and they see books with characters that look like them. They're more apt to pick it up.
And we've seen in these book bans that a lot of those that are targeted for ban are not just women authors, which are far and away the majority, but also books that are about and for children, people of color.
Yeah. Teaching true history, you know, all the things that we should have our children learn.
And the gay and lesbian community as well.
Same.
So those are books that you're choosing at Cafe Resistance. Is that kind of, is selling books, putting books out there the goal? Or, I mean, because there's also kind of a community coffee shop element.
So it is the goal as well. The goal is to get a rise and to increase the literacy rates in the community, right? It's no coincidence that I decided to put it in on Soutel, which is it is in my district, but it is also in an area where those students are not necessarily on grade level. And so we wanted to just create a space where they can come, they can get books, but they can also learn about true history. They can also come and be revitalized. The village is going to revitalize itself there. So we consider ourselves the community hub as well.
So how did you engage your daughter in reading when she was young? She's working this bookstore with you.
Yes, she's going to be working the bookstore with me. So, you know, Natalie did not like to read when she was younger, and she also had issues, self-esteem issues. And so I asked her, did she want to write a book with me once? And she said, yeah. I said, but you have to read more books because no one wants to read the same things over and over again. And you learn more words when you're reading. And so we wrote a comic book. We entered it into the One Spark Festival and we won. And we traveled the country, even all the way to Alaska, to promote her book and to write, you know, teach writing workshops.
That's really extraordinary. For people who don't know that story,
The Adventures of Moxie McGriff.
That's right, Moxie. And that really was a story that was just kind of everywhere here in town. And she was everywhere.
Yeah, she was everywhere across the country as well. Like I said, we traveled all over.
So, Shani, you're an IT executive by trade. What inspired you to begin writing?
Actually, it's a funny story. I've always told funny stories to my kids. I think, as Angie says, to try to encourage my kids to read more. We've always took the opportunity to write stories together. But when my granddaughter was born about 2 years ago, we worked with her on different languages and learning different languages. So the story is she was learning Mandarin at the time, and working with foster kids, it's amazing how many kids don't leave their block and how many kids don't get the chance to travel to different places. And, you know, with my kids, we were able to travel around the world, and I wanted to share some of those experiences with the other kids. So we created a book called Kobe Travels. And it focuses on a minority little girl traveling to different places, learning about the country and learning about the different languages.
And so you did one Kobe travels to Spain, another one, Kobe travels to Cuba. Are those experiences that you've had or been able to share with your family, or are they just imagined through the literature?
Nope, they're experiences that we've had with my family. So my family had the opportunity to travel to these places. And I think that by kids reading about these different places not only encourages them to want to try and explore more because someone like them is doing it, but also gives us a cultural tolerance that is very much needed in our salad bowl of culture today.
So there's a festival coming up this weekend on the 1st of June. What is the goal of the festival? What's the focus of the festival?
So the focus of this festival is Women Writing for Change with Rebel Readers. We are sponsoring around 30 to 40 different authors to come out to talk to the community and also to get the opportunity to sell their books.
All right. And Casey, there's 5 independent bookstores owned by women in the city right now. That's kind of amazing.
It is.
It is a different time right now.
It is. It's an excellent time for local authors and local bookstores to uplift their voices. And we hope to do that through the festival as well.
And Representative Nixon, you're going to be speaking. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about what it's like to open up a bookstore and the need for us to support literacy in our communities now. And also just that we are giving love to each other. There's no competition. We want our children to read and we want to have a better educated and well-informed society.
So if somebody's interested in going, Shawnee, what can they do?
They can definitely follow us on all social medias as Women Writing for Change Jacksonville. But more importantly, we are at Cork this weekend. So they can meet us there at 11 o'clock on Saturday.
And it runs from 1 to 3.
11 to
3. 11 to 3. All right. Great. Well, thank you, Angie Nixon, Shawnee Hall, Casey Trullio. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks
appreciate
for
it.
Having us.
Thank you for having us.
Y'all come out and support.
All right. Up next, the producer of a noir remake with the city of St. Augustine as a central character.
Honduras, family members of the disappeared have been marching for 40 years, demanding justice for victims of state violence.
Muchos países ya han hecho justicia. Nosotros no.
This lawmaker says other countries have already served justice, but not us. Refusing to give up on disappeared loved ones in Honduras, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9. the ancient philosophy of Stoicism is having a renaissance.
This question of like, well, what's a good framework or operating system for like being a person in this crazy world? That to me is what Stoicism is. And it's kind of been refined over thousands of years.
A refined operating system. Well, that's tech bro speak, but Stoicism is drawing adherents far beyond Silicon Valley. We'll find out why. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Rachel Summerstein about the history of C-sections, why we're seeing an increase, her own harrowing experience of having one without anesthesia, and how the medicalization of childbirth has, in some instances, taken agency away from a mother's ability to control her birthing experience. Summerstein has a new book. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The Federal Theater Project introduced millions of Americans to the power of plays in the 1930s. It was a time when political leadership saw the theater as vital to democracy, and then the project was destroyed. The story of how that happened and what it reveals about efforts to undermine the arts today. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
What are you going to do?
Find out why there was a man.
You've been dealt a bad deal, so don't make it worse.
So did they tell you how long?
A couple days, a week at most, if I stay quiet.
Yeah, but you haven't stayed quiet, have you?
Aha, a classic noir film. And if you're a film noir buff, there's a new version of this 1950s classic, and it may look oddly familiar. Joining me now to share more about remaking DOA, filmed entirely in St. Augustine, is producer and director Kurt St. Thomas. Good morning, Kurt.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So this is a 1950s film. It has already been remade four times. Why did you want to reinvent the wheel here?
Well, it started, I was living in Los Angeles, and I was searching for ideas for movies, and I'm not a good screenwriter at all. And so my default was I should find out if there's a film in the public domain, and started looking through public domain films, and I saw DOA, and I immediately, it caught my eye because I love things that are very symmetrical. And I was like, that will look great on a poster, you know, real easy. And right as I saw it, in my head, I started singing this song by the band X, and it's called I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. And in that song, John Doe and Exene Cervenka, the two members of the band that sing, they sing a line, DOA, and they're actually referring to the Canadian punk band from the late 70s, but I could just hear John saying, DOA. And for some reason, I was like, wow, it'd be cool to remake that movie. And John Doe would be the best lead actor. And he's totally got this Robert Mitchum vibe. And
you'd worked with John Doe on a previous film about 20 years ago called Red Right Hand, which is a Nick Cave song. So
yes,
you have a lot of musical influences.
We've known each other for a long time. I worked in radio for a long time, and that's where we became friends. And I had also directed a music video for Kathleen Edwards called Back to Me. And John, I cast John as her boyfriend in the video. And all of a sudden, Hurricane Matthew happened. And my mom, who lives in St. Augustine, she's 84. And it was just that her house was really destroyed by flooding. And it was that moment where I said, I need to move to Florida to be with my mom. And at that moment, I bought a house in Lincolnville. And all of a sudden, it was announced that X was going to play the amphitheater, and ended up hanging out with John for a couple of days. And I pitched him on the idea. And he was like, oh, yeah, sure. And he never thought I was going to make it. And then it took about 2 years from that point to actually get him to come to St. Augustine for a month to make the movie.
As it happens, the house that you bought and moved into with your mom that you share actually has kind of a rock and roll history, too.
Yeah, my mom actually lives next door to me, but my house, which I didn't know until about at least a year, I found out that this guy lived in my house, Chris Pyle, and his dad is Artemis Pyle, who's a Leonard drummer Skinner. For Leonard Skinner. And I immediately knew Chris Pyle was the guy who played drums in Royal Trucks, a kind of offbeat band that I happen to love. And I actually friended Chris Pyle on Facebook, and we've had a few chats. But my fiance, on our like second date or so, she was wearing a Royal Trucks T-shirt. And I was like, well, she's the woman for me.
That's the one.
And by the way, come move into the house. And yeah.
So we should get to the film. There are so many familiar sites that people who know St. Augustine will see in this film. There's the Gator Farm. There's the Leitner Museum. There's Price's Barbershop. there's the Bridge of Lions. It really is like a central character in a way.
It is. And it's, I mean, almost the entire movie is filmed within blocks of my house. So that was kind of one advantage. People were like, why did you film it here? And I'm like, well, look at it. It's amazing. All these crazy locations, and it's just beautiful. And I could see how I could make it look like 1949 without too much effort and digital erasing and things like that. And
was it difficult to get permissions to shoot in St. Augustine?
No, it was actually pretty easy. I met this guy, Marty Lewis, who was unfortunately passed, and Marty ran the film commission there. And I had a meeting with him, and he basically set it all up, and I had to pay the whopping price of $35 for a permit to film the entire movie.
That's extraordinary. Well, you can see DOA on many streaming platforms. You can watch it for free on Tubi. Kurt, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here. I love the station, and it's exciting.
Well, we love to hear that. And good luck on your next project.
Thank you.
All right. And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight or find our entire program archive on your favorite podcast platform. Join us tomorrow when we talk to an author who tells the stories of 10 people who are connected by the Holocaust and Jacksonville. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.